Welcome to the Passport Play Podcast with Jonathan Lord. This episode's guest, Jonathan Abrams, is the author of Boys Among Men, How the Prep to Pro Generation Redefined the NBA and Sparked a Basketball Revolution. Let's get you out of the blocks with a pretty easy one here. How much of the Golden State Warriors' current success can be attributed to a prep to pro player like Sean Livingston?
Obvious that Sean has provided a lot of depth in that backcourt. It's not often that a team has a player of his caliber with as much of a high basketball IQ being able to come off the bench, so that's a real luxury for them to have.
It was a semi-serious question because I think we're all kind of caught up in the fanfare surrounding the Golden State Warriors right now, as they currently are tied with the Chicago Bulls for the most wins in a single season and have a chance to break that record. And I think a lot of people just attribute that success to, you know, some of the top players, but it really is a collective team effort. And you've written before about a guy like Sean Livingston, and the remarkable thing about the Warriors and Livingston is that there are so many diverse stories and backgrounds on that team, but yet they seem to blend together so well. And that's clearly a huge part of their success.
Yeah, I mean, that's always a fun thing, seeing one team united for a common goal and, you know, seeing guys fall into place. Probably the biggest thing that happened was Andre Iguodala going to the bench and allowing Draymond to start. That's really what precipitated that whole thing. Or no, it was David Lee at the time. And then Andre went to the bench for Harrison.
You've been following the game of basketball, I assume, for a long time. Can you remember specifically or pinpoint specifically what it was about the game that first had you hooked?
I mean, I'm an LA kid, so I grew up during the Showtime Lakers, and that had me. I mean, I remember when I was little trying to look in the mirror and smile like Magic Johnson.
How did that go? Did it work?
I think I have a good smile.
Well, Magic had that charisma and that charm, and the Showtime Lakers were, well, I guess depending on who you rooted for, what coast you were on, were really an attractive team. Do you see any similarities between the Showtime Lakers and the Golden State Warriors? I know everyone draws the parallels between the Warriors and the Bulls right now, but do you see any signs of that Lakers team in the 80s here with the Warriors now?
Sometimes on the fast break, I mean, you know, Steph is obviously a wizard with the basketball, and you love seeing Magic do those type of things. I just think that where they end is Magic was obviously 6'8", 6'9", and wasn't pulling up for threes off of transition. So, but, you know, sometimes when he's going to the rack off of a fast break, you kind of see similarities in some of the passes that Steph is able to conjure with his mind.
So you patterned your smile off of Magic Johnson, but what about your game? Did you pattern your game off of Magic, or were you more of a James Worthy type of guy, a Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, a Michael Cooper? I mean, where are we here?
You know, I don't see the similarities, but friends say that I play like Antoine Walker. I don't take those. They say it jokingly in that I'm a tall guy who likes to shoot threes. I don't like it, but you know, I'll defer to their judgment.
So they must see something in your post shot making shimmy that would give them the sense that you're a lot like Antoine then, huh?
I do have a shimmy.
Shimmies are good. Are you? Let me ask you this: are you a fan who believes that the Warriors? I mean, this is pretty hard to argue against, but that the Warriors are really good for basketball, or are you someone who thinks that there needs to be a competitive balance? Because heading into the playoffs this weekend, I mean, I don't know how many teams you think have a legitimate shot at winning the NBA title, but most people would just rattle off probably 3, 4, 5 teams, maybe tops, that have a legitimate chance at winning the title. So are the Warriors good for basketball, or do you think there needs to be more of a competitive balance?
I mean, that's how it is every year. You know, every year there's only legitimately 3, 4, 5 teams you think can honestly win an NBA title. I mean, we're not talking about football here. Basketball is a star-driven sport where if you have the best players, you're going to be in the best position to win at the end of the year. I mean, would it be good if I was the Detroit Pistons or Milwaukee Bucks, yeah, but, you know, sports is all cyclical. So the Warriors were down a few years ago, they're up now. Lakers are up a few years ago, they're down now. So, I mean, it'll all come around and even out eventually.
Are you rooting for the Warriors to break the record?
Good question. Yeah, I mean, I think records are meant to be broken. You know, I'm not a fan of all this compare and contrast with the 96 Bulls to these Warriors because, there's no way to accurately do that. I guess it's fun for fans to debate and analysts to kill time, but, you know, it's just, you can't say what would happen if the teams would ever face up.
Well, you can't, but maybe I can. And it's and it's funny because you would have done the same thing if let's just say hypothetically your Showtime Lakers were the team that had held the record prior to now the Warriors tying, and I'm sure you would have been more willing to hold these parlor room conversations about your Lakers being better than this iteration of the Warriors. And so I grew up a huge fan of the Bulls, and like a lot of us did, and that 95-96 team was not just statistically, but, you know, it was the eye test best team you ever watched play, at least, you know, I thought I watched play. And to see the Warriors break it, it does kind of change, at least it changes my perception of a team I grew up rooting for.
I don't think it should. I mean, those Bulls lost a game to Vancouver that year. So what if they were 73-9 except for that loss? I mean, does it really change all that much?
Well, they had big country Brian Reeves, so, I mean, that we're not talking about a total walkover with the Grizzlies.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, I'm just trying to make the case for how there. I know you don't like comparisons, but there are comparisons. And I frankly think that it is wonderful for basketball right now, especially younger kids, younger generation, just getting into the sport. I mean, like when we were kids, we never forgot the first teams we rooted for. And now you have a whole new generation of kids that are going to be, you know, fans of the game of basketball in part because of the Warriors' success. And we can't not like that, right?
I mean, maybe it'll open the door for kids who are just getting into basketball to know Michael Jordan other than the crying Michael Jordan and other than the guy who sells shoes.
Yeah.
I think that's good.
Yeah, the crying Michael Jordan. If Magic Johnson is known now for his smile, as you tried to pattern your smile after, I don't know if there are many people who are trying to pattern their crying after Michael Jordan, but unfortunately, it seems like we're going to have an entire generation of people who do think of Michael Jordan as the crying face on Jordan Spieth when he's presenting the green jacket to Danny Willett.
Yeah, being in my early 30s, it's a shame for people to see Michael Jordan reduced into that fashion.
Yeah, it is. But then you realize how much money Michael Jordan has and you don't feel terribly bad for him.
True.
All right, let's talk about, let's get right to your book because there's so many fascinating things to cover with the story and all the different narratives that you've kind of woven together. Let me first start by asking, where did this idea come from?
So I've done a few profiles on for Grantland on guys who had made the jump from high school to the NBA, Sean Livingston being one, and it just seemed like their path to NBA stability was more arduous than guys who had gone to college. So that really stuck out to me. That was one reason. And another reason was because my high school senior year was the same year as Tyson Chandler, Kwame Brown, and Eddie Curry. And I just remember all those predictions for them back then that Eddie was the next Shaq and Tyson was the next Kevin Garnett. And they fell pretty short of those predictions. So I wanted to see, you know, what happened in the course of that decade plus. So yeah, that was kind of the basis for it.
And this is largely an authentic piece of reporting. It's amazing to me reading through this book that no one had really taken the time to chronicle this story quite like you. I were you shocked when you settled on this idea that it really hadn't been done before?
No, because I mean, if you want to tell a story in its totality, you gotta wait until you can tell it in its entirety. And, you know, when I started it, it was getting toward the end of this run where the players were kind of who they were going to be at that point in their career. I mean, when I started on this, Kobe was still at the top of his game. I had no idea that he was going to be injured so much the last couple of years and ultimately retire. Now the timing, I guess, just worked out for me and not for him. But, you know, when I started on the idea, it was kind of the first time that you could probably tell the story in its entirety.
So if this idea started for you, maybe back, I mean, it sounds like it started back for you, you know, when you're graduating high school, but you actually began work on it in earnest when Kobe was at his peak as a player. So how many years ago was that?
I began work on this book in 2012.
Okay. I guess we're being a little generous with the Kobe peak then.
Well, I mean, look at his scoring average. He's probably averaging, I'd imagine, high 20s at that point, and he hadn't, you know, missed the bulk of any season yet.
I kid. Just because it's kind of fun to be down on Kobe, even though, you know, most people are celebrating his retirement this week. So, but in earnest, the story of prep to pros really does begin with Moses Malone. And for those listening who might not know a lot about Moses, not as much as you do, can you just tell us a little bit about how groundbreaking his decision was in 1974? It was 1974, right?
75.
Well, sorry.
Close enough. Yeah, I mean, Moses was a pioneer in this regard to, you know, back then it was the Wild Wild West in college recruiting, so he was basically missing all of school to be recruited and have people kind of make him offers under the table until he finally committed to Maryland and left UTRZL. But then Bucky Buckwalter, who was a GM for the Utah Stars of the ABA, had scouted him and came up with the grand idea that he'd try to get a high school player, and it was almost seen as a joke at the time, but Moses kind of had that conviction to where he had actually enrolled at Maryland and was there for about a week before he decided to make the decision to go pro straight out of high school. And, you know, it didn't really even open the doors all that much back then. The next year, a couple guys made the jump into the NBA from high school in Daryl Dawkins and Bill Willoughby, but then it was another two entire decades before Kevin Garnett was the next guy.
You know, why was, before Moses, who you rightly credit as being a pioneer, why was it considered a joke, almost a publicity stunt? It seems strange to me that 1975 was the first time we see this. It feels like it should have happened earlier. Why didn't it happen earlier?
I mean, basketball isn't football, but it's definitely a physical game and seen as a man's game, where guys just were looked at as not being physically developed enough to be able to battle in the post or play against tougher, stiffer, older, more mentally competent competition.
But it just strikes me as strange that someone wouldn't have taken a flyer before then. But what also is strange, and you said this in the book, and you said it here during our conversation, and that's that there was nearly a 20-year, I don't know if lull is the right word, but benchmark, if you will, between these real dynamic prep-to-pro players from Moses Malone in 75 to then Kevin Garnett in 1995. Why those bookends? Why then jump right ahead to Kevin Garnett?
I think that NBA is like all sports in that they're a copycat league where they're going to mimic success or mimic failure. And, you know, those three guys in the 70s with Moses, Daryl Dawkins, and Bill Willoughby was almost like a microcosm for what was to come later. You saw the guy who was probably ready mentally and physically and being able to make that jump in Moses Malone. And then Daryl Dawkins was a guy who had all the potential in the world, who had all the physical tools, but maybe wasn't there really mentally yet, and his career kind of reflected as such. And then had a guy like Bill Willoughby who never came close to matching his potential, either physically or mentally, as a basketball contributor. So I think teams kind of saw the cautionary tales with Dawkins and Bill Willoughby, and kind of left it alone for a long time and almost forgot about it. I mean, at that point in time, basketball probably wasn't even viewed as one of the bigger sports in this country. It was still kind of a off the radar type thing. The finals were being played on tape delay, and you know, college was looked at as almost the true minor leagues. And, you know, it wasn't until kind of Magic and Bird came along in college and that success transferred to the NBA, where the NBA was looked on as a viable and serious pro sport.
Your book is chock full of cautionary tales, you know, guys who took that fork in a road and whose life could have been so much different if they just made a different decision. Bill Willoughby's is one I had no idea about prior to reading your book. Can you share a little bit about how different his life could have been? I mean, you kind of mentioned how he wasn't able to make it in the NBA, a combination of physicality and the mental side of the game, but what ended up happening to his life is really interesting, and how you kind of uncovered some of that was, I thought, pretty neat.
Yeah, I mean, he's an interesting guy, and he was one of the first to make this jump, and he was this cautionary tale, but then, you know, also more than two decades later, he went back and got his college degree, and, you know, I think he was just a guy who, at that time in his life, he was not mature mentally or physically, ready for the NBA, and you know, his career reflected as much, but he was also able to use the knowledge that he had gained to try to lend his advice and voice to other guys who considered making that jump down the road. And he actually told Kevin Garnett to make that jump, to try to get the money while he could.
Yeah, that's part of why your book works so well, is that you have all these separate narratives, yet they're all woven together, and the connection of Bill Willoughby as someone who didn't make it as a player, leaving directly from high school to the pros, yet he's also someone who's instrumental in Kevin Garnett's eventual decision to bypass college and go directly to the pros. I found that really, really interesting. And in the Kevin Garnett, you know, do you think he was the real perfect player slash person to usher in this prep to pro era starting in 1995? I mean, could it have been somebody else, or did it have to be Kevin Garnett? Was it just something about Kevin Garnett that led to this?
Yeah, I mean, Kevin was a good torchbearer. I also think Kobe, who came along the next year, would have probably worked just as fine. But Kevin was so disciplined and narrow-mindedly focused on basketball at that time, where he didn't have really any other interests. I mean, he wasn't even cashing his paychecks week to week. He was just letting them pile up in his locker room. I mean, he would just focus on playing basketball and trying to get better. And he was also, you know, a lot of people probably don't know that he was also a pretty big historian of the game. So he knew the guys who came before him. He knew Bill Russell and all those guys, et cetera. So he knew what type of history and impact that his decision would have, and he was disciplined enough to kind of set a goal and keep his mind straight and go forward and achieve that goal.
How much of his decision was because of his low test scores? I remember when he first was coming into the NBA, that was what all the talk was about, was that he would have gone to college if it weren't for having low ACT scores. Do you feel like that was a major part of the decision, or the media made it bigger than it really was?
I think it was probably part of the equation. I mean, I think he eventually passed and got his test scores, but by then his mind was made up. So, I mean, it probably played part of the equation. I think he was kind of in the forefront as far as being a trailblazer, in that he realized that the colleges were going to benefit off of him had he gone to college financially, and he wouldn't have been able to take part in that financial payoff. So I think he wanted to be paid for what he was doing. And, you know, in that sense, I don't think he's different than a lot of guys right now who are almost forced to go to college.
They pretty much are forced to go to college, which is definitely something I wanted to discuss with you a little bit later. But before we get there, it seems that if it weren't going to be Kevin Garnett, it was going to be Kobe Bryant, and they were right next to each other as far as years go. And the Kobe thing that fascinated me with your book, and I don't remember this at the time, but the story about how Kobe could have been drafted by several teams, including the New Jersey Nets, I thought was a fascinating story, and how different worlds could have been if John Calipari, you know, they had their way and were able to draft. Well, I guess he was their second choice, but it just seems that the basketball history could have been slightly different if Kobe Bryant went to the Nets. We could be talking about the University of Kentucky not having as much success as it's had in recent years because Calipari never leaves because he's now a successful NBA coach.
Yeah, that 96 draft part was probably my funnest chapter to write and report, just because so many twists and coincidences and turns had to happen for Kobe to end up being drafted 13th by the Hornets and ultimately traded to the Lakers. I mean, that was fun. Just like I said too, I'd grown up in Los Angeles, so I remember it happening real time. But to be able to go back and talk to the general managers and coaches who ultimately made those decisions, I mean, just an example, starting off at the top of that draft, the 76ers had the first pick, and they could have had Allen Iverson and Kobe Bryant in the same backcourt. Not that there would have been enough shots to go around for both of them, but you just think about the possibilities, and that would have been really, really fun to possibly have seen. But, you know, they weren't going to trade Stackhouse at that time, who they had just drafted the year before, even though Tony DeLeo, who was a scout for the 76ers at that time, was preparing Kobe for the draft and was petitioning the 76ers GM to draft Kobe.
But it seems like in 96, this is a year after Garnett, and it's clear that the stigma still existed, right? The stigma against high school players. If Kobe, we're just going on pure talent, Kobe Bryant, you know, maybe the most talented player in the draft coming out of high school, but the stigma still existed as far as, you know, taking high school players is a major, major gamble.
Oh, without a doubt. And I mean, the biggest example of that is that the Timberwolves just had success in drafting KG. You know, KG obviously wasn't an MVP player yet, but you could tell he was going to be successful. The Timberwolves had the fourth pick in that draft, and they ended up taking Stephon Marbury, or they traded with the Bucks to get Stephon Marbury because they didn't want to tempt fate twice, is how Kevin McHale explained it to me. They just thought they got lucky with KG, and they didn't want to take that risk again, so they didn't want to take a high school player in consecutive drafts.
They got lucky with KG and didn't want to take the risk again. Really, that's what it came down to.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was a quote. I don't think actually it was a quote attributed to Kobe, but it was something somebody said about Kobe, about how he was upset that Garnett was the trailblazer, groundbreaker, and he wasn't. Is that true? Is that a quote attributed to Kobe, or is that somebody in his circle?
Yeah, that was his high school coach, Greg Downer, said that he thought Kobe wanted to be the first guy in a couple decades to make that jump from high school.
And that offers, I think, you've also mentioned how Garnett had a sense of history on his mind when he made the decision, or at least he understood his place in basketball, legend and lore, when he made his decision. But the two men themselves are very different as far as coming from very different backgrounds. And you talked a little bit about how maybe, you know, the paycheck was perhaps more important to Garnett at first, coming from where he came from, and with Bryant, it, you know, it wasn't as important right away. So the two men themselves offer a really interesting contrast.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Kobe, he hadn't even grown up in the United States. I mean, he had grown up in Italy, where his dad was finishing up his pro basketball career. So, you know, it's much different from KG growing up in South Carolina and then transferring to a school in Chicago and, you know, harnessing his basketball skills there.
So there's no formula for this. Neither one of us are scientists. I mean, we can't come up with an equation that can predict what's going to make for a successful prep to pro player. But if you had to say, you know, break down the percentages, how much of it comes down to talent? How much of it comes down to circumstance? How much of it comes down to just pure luck when assessing the careers of all these prep to pro players? Because there doesn't seem to be just one template, right? I mean, you that would be a boring book. That would be an easy subject to research. Oh, you just look at the mathematic model here, and I can tell you who's going to end up being a good player. I mean, what does it come down to?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you hit it right on the head. There is no easy answer, and I'm sure you could have a million NBA executives telling you as much. You know, I think the one common characteristic that linked all these guys is that the guys who were able to succeed were mature beyond their years, where in high school your day is really regimented. You're going to class, you're going to practice, you're going to go do homework, and then you're going to repeat it the next day. And then, you know, if you leave high school and then you're pro for the first time, you have money for the first time in your life. So a lot of these guys, you have all the time in the world in the day because you're only practicing a couple hours, and, you know, that's a recipe for a lot of people to get into a lot of trouble. And I think the guys who were able to succeed were mature beyond their years and able to focus and use that time to work on their game and improve on their craft. And they saw getting drafted not as in the moment they made it, not as I'm here. They saw it as the first step in a process, and it was going to be a gradual road, and they would have to continue to work hard to end up at their ultimate destination.
Yeah, the process. I love how you describe that people who end up succeeding when it comes to prep to pro are the types of talents and players who understand that it's a long road, and it's going to be filled with ups and downs, and being able to sustain that work ethic and that interest and that focus, you know, after that immediate rush of success and money. Even after that first taste of stardom, you haven't accomplished anything. And to be able to push yourself to be great, there's no real way to, I guess, tell that when evaluating some of these guys. I another story that kind of made me sad in your book was that of Kwame Brown, not just because Michael Jordan, again, here wasn't very nice to him, but more because it really seemed from your work that a guy like Kwame Brown wanted to go to college.
Yeah, I mean, just look at the type of external factors that he had on him. You know, his mom was on disability. She couldn't really work. I think he had two brothers in jail. His dad had murdered his girlfriend after Kwame's mom had left him. So, you know, they needed that, and they needed it then and there. So, I mean, a lot of these guys had just external factors that had nothing to do with playing basketball that kind of pushed them in the directions of playing for the NBA out of high school and getting that paycheck as soon as you can.
Was that this raises an interesting point. Was that a commonality as far as perhaps an indicator of guys who weren't going to last, that weren't going to be long-term successes in the NBA, the guys who needed to turn pro in order to provide for families or for other monetary reasons?
I mean, I don't think there's any one single indicator or influence when you can say, okay, this is it. I think it's more nuanced than that. It's not black and white. There's a lot of gray involved.
Well, one guy who certainly there was no gray for was LeBron James. And I don't know if you know, the rules were changed after a guy like LeBron James. I mean, it just seems to me like LeBron James, the revolutionary, the star, you know, that was recognized as a star well before he reached high school. Was he the reason they ended up changing the rules in 2006, 2005? I mean, when was that? It was 2005 or 2006 that the NBA mandated at least 1 year out of high school. Was that 2006?
It was, let's see.
05, I think it was around 05 or 06, right?
Yeah, 2005 was the last draft where high school guys could make that jump.
Yeah, now, it would make no sense if it were because of LeBron, but it does fall right after he was drafted. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, a couple years after. I don't think it was because of LeBron. You know, if there were more LeBron, the NBA would obviously be opening its door a lot sooner for these guys. I think it was probably the influence he had where he almost made it look easy, and then it just became after that, if you were, you know, at the top of your class, it wasn't even a decision anymore. You were going to try to make this jump.
Yeah, but where do you stand on this rule as far as, you know, the NBA is saying you need 1 year out of high school, and it's clearly a rule which is supposed to benefit the NBA. Now, you could argue that this rule doesn't necessarily either benefit the NBA or certainly the players in question here, because from a player's perspective, this is potentially a rule that cuts their earning power down by a year, right? That's one less year these guys have to make money. And from an NBA's team's perspective, with the watershed of revenues that are kind of streaming in now, are we really talking about that much more money that these NBA teams can make by preventing players from jumping right from the preps to pros?
I don't even think it's about how much money these players can make. It's about the NBA executives being able to make good decisions and predictions on where these guys are going to end up as NBA players, and it was hard for them to make those type of assessments with high school guys. You know, I think that I can definitely see both sides of the issue. You know, how David Stern explained it to me is that, you know, if you're a journalist for the New York Times, or if you're the New York Times, then why not mandate that all of your journalists have journalism degrees? It's why aren't you as a business allowed to set those terms of employment for your employees? And that makes a lot of sense. You know, I think the problem that I have is that, you know, Stern is saying that the NBA is a business, so they're running the best business they can, but I think it's ignoring the societal impacts where you can't really wash your hands of that as well. You know, I would love to see like a baseball type rule where guys are allowed to make the jump if they're that talented, but if they do go to school, if they do decide to go to college, then they have to stay for at least 2 years, because in that fashion, then they'll be a lot closer to getting their college degree. You know, I don't think Ben Simmons and what happened to him this year at LSU really helped him out at all, and it didn't really help out the college program, to be honest. You know, it's not like they're a national program now.
Yeah, my next question was about Ben Simmons, because I really feel I don't know who to feel for. I don't know enough about his situation to weigh in on you know what happened down there, but it doesn't seem like it worked out for anyone involved, either Ben Simmons or the LSU program. And when you have a player as talented as Ben Simmons, who at least from the outside clearly had very little interest in being a college basketball player. Is that fair to say? I mean, just from watching him on the court, it didn't seem like he really wanted to be there. And I can't help but think that much of that was because of the rules, and that he had no choice. And when you see a player like that kind of just going through the motions and only lasting, you know, a year, how can that be good for college basketball? How can that be good for his NBA stock?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. It's not like he's going to be a chemist next year, so what's the point of him going to school at all? You know, and it just delays him on his path. It hurts the NBA, too, because, you know, this is a year less where he's able to completely focus in his attention toward basketball. So he's not able to be, you know, a star or basketball contributor to the NBA as soon as possible. I just think that it doesn't help out anybody.
Yeah, but you know, who do most people blame for this rule, this one and done rule? I think most people, would you say, kind of direct their ire towards the NCAA, right? Do you think that most people probably say, well, this is an NCAA rule, not an NBA rule?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely the NBA has definitely created it, but, you know, the NBA is also saying they don't have to go to college for a year. They can go to Italy or China or just hang out for a year. They're just saying that they just want their players to be at least a year removed from high school.
The way scouting works, okay, so maybe that logic works more in the mid-2000s, but the way scouting works nowadays, it's not like these NBA executives really don't have enough tape on these guys. I mean, you turn on ESPN and you're watching, you know, high school select tournaments. And I mean, these guys are getting national exposure. So if the logic today is, well, we need to know talent-wise where these guys fit in, I'm not necessarily buying that anymore.
Yeah, I agree. But even somebody like Dante Exum, I mean, nobody's really seen him play all that much before he came into the NBA.
Yeah, and I wonder how much getting kind of closer to your idea about, okay, look, you can either come out directly out of high school, or you can, if you go to college, you got to spend 2-3 years there, the baseball model. What is kind of standing in the NBA's way of perhaps updating those rules? Do you see any downside to your plan? I mean, it's not your plan, not to discredit your idea, but a lot of people I've heard talk about that. What's preventing the NBA from perhaps updating their ideas?
I mean, the NBA does want to update it. They want to make it to 2 years flat. I mean, they just don't want high school kids to come out into the NBA. They think that their guys are able to make better judgments and better assessments with guys who are more mature and developed physically and mentally.
So wait, if the NBA had its way, it wouldn't just be 1 year, it would be 2 years?
Yep.
Wow. Aren't there, I guess there aren't laws against that, but isn't there some kind of like labor laws preventing? I guess not. I mean, with a league saying that you can't play for us until you get to a certain age. I mean, there sounds like this is some sort of antitrust.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's all their rules are collective bargain. So, you know, the Players Association is ultimately agreeing to whatever rules are laid down before them.
But one of the other things that kind of confuses me is that in recent years we've had kind of a flood of players from overseas. Do the same rules apply to overseas players as far as when they can come over? Do they need to be 19? Do they need to be 1 year removed from high school? Or how does that work?
Yeah, they need to be, I think it's 19, I want to say, because their high school can be kind of iffy. It's some type of similar rules in place.
Okay, so it's not as if there are different rules for international players than there are for basketball players in the United States.
No.
So do you foresee, okay, so if 2004-05, right around there, was the apex of high school players entering the NBA draft, and I think, did you say this in your book, that there were something like 8 or 9, you know, high school players picked in the first 20 or so picks? Was that was 2004, right?
Correct.
So do we, the numbers nowadays in drafts, how many of those top 20 picks are freshmen nowadays? If we were to forecast the upcoming draft, how many of those top picks are freshmen? Do you think half, kind of like what it was in 2004 with high schoolers?
I mean, it's up there. I haven't gone through and done the numbers, so I can't say off the top of my head. But yeah, I would imagine that they would be up there, and I would imagine that the majority of guys who have been, say, the top 3 picks over the last few years have probably been mostly guys who have only spent 1 year in college.
Yeah, and my point here is there any way of predicting their success after 1 year of college, right? Aren't we talking about the same success to burnout, you know, ratio here? I mean, we're still talking, is that 1 year making that much of a difference as far as the number of basketball players that succeed?
Yeah, I mean, it's really tough to say. I mean, I'd have to almost run the numbers, but yeah, it's tough.
It's certainly interesting. At least I wonder, does that year really make a difference in the evaluation of a player? Does that lead to more successful careers? Because so much about what your book was about was how there's no predictor for success. And I wonder if you just look at the one and done players, you could probably argue the same thing based on the careers of a lot of one and done guys, let's say in the last 10 years.
Yeah, but at least the NBA is, you know, being able to see them play against that better competition for a whole entire year. So, I mean, I think at least they think that it helps them.
Well, maybe I'm giving you an idea for book number two. Actually, I did want to ask you about what you're working on now, as far as ideas and things that are kind of capturing your interest today.
Yeah, I mean, I'm working on a couple different projects, and hopefully, I'll be able to announce them pretty soon. I gotta dot a couple I's and cross a couple T's, and hopefully, I'll be able to make announcements pretty soon.
Oh, cool! Can you? Will they be basketball related, or perhaps will you be looking at other sports as well?
I'd say both.
Okay, interesting.
Too coy here, but yeah.
No, that's fine. I get it. You don't want to do anything before it's been announced. Okay, so if I gave you last question, and then I'll let you go. Thank you so much for your time, Jonathan. But last question, if I gave you the Warriors versus the field in the 2016 NBA playoffs, who are you taking?
I would take the Warriors.
Versus the entire field?
Yep, wouldn't you?
This is like the old Tiger Woods versus the field at major championships. Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I would really have to... I'd really have to sink my teeth into it, but I don't the Spurs always sandbag during the regular season? I mean, they're the most likely dethroners.
Possibly. Still take the Warriors, though.
All right, so I'd have to sweeten my odds. I guess I'd have to turn the table somewhat slightly. All right, I think most people would take the Warriors, too. Anyway, Jonathan Abrams, thank you so much for taking the time to chit-chat with me and continued success with your book.
All right, I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Have a good day. That's it for this edition of the Passport Play Podcast. To download this and every episode, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or by visiting passportplay.tumblr.com. Thanks for listening, and talk to you again soon.